Now, let's return to the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. We're doing our news on this hour with a very special focus on the coronavirus in the second half of the show. Bobby Wilder is going to call back in with some new news from mainland China and Hong Kong and other stories that I think you'll find very fascinating. We certainly do. Meanwhile, we're going to cover some of our other news that we have for you.
That's right. We usually like to look up at the sky, at least for a little while contemplating the future.
Yeah, you know, to remind ourselves that, you know, there are a trillion other planets in this local galaxy alone. And yeah, they don't seem very real because we don't hear much from them. But that's what we're here for, to sort
of relevance. Here. The closer it is to your hand, the more relevant it is to your day.
So, the Space Force is in the news. Talk about relevance and stuff that we should be aware of that we wouldn't have been aware of.
Tell me about the NASA. Space Force. I'm not really aware of what happened with the Space Force today.
Yes. Well, Russian satellites have been exhibiting an unusual and disturbing behavior, according to the commander of the Space Force.
Mm-hmm.
Last November, the Russian government launched a satellite, and then it kind of gave birth to a baby. It released the second satellite.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And our Space Force Commander, John Raymond, who's U.S. Space Command Commander. Command Commander. That's good. Say that three times. He says these satellites have been actively maneuvering near a U.S. government satellite. Now, what could a U.S. government satellite be doing?
Surveilling the planet?
Well, good guess.
Okay, yeah. So they're looking at us and the Russian satellites are looking at them. Sound about right?
Yeah, well, this is something we've seen before. Apparently, Space Command has noted that another set of satellites back in 2017 deployed by the Russians characterized similar patterns, certain behavior. They call them inspector satellites.
Inspector satellites, I
yes.
see.
Yeah.
They're here to check you out.
They're spying on the spy satellites, basically.
Well, isn't that what a lot of those satellites are doing up there? That's why they're going to space, is because you want to be in the higher ground, right?
Spy on the spies?
Spy on the spies. That's right. You want to be top spy. Get your satellite a little higher than the other one.
I wonder if they'll have moles. We'll have a mole satellite.
Those will be under the sea. No.
We thought
moles
it was ours.
Under the earth.
We thought it was ours, but it was really theirs. Yeah. Mm. Probably more likely hacking.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what does this have to do with the Space Force?
Well, the
Force?
Importance of this, it's the first substantive statement from the Space Force as a new government force.
Mm-hmm. And so the Space Force made a statement about it?
Yes, they said that they did this, that this is what they're doing, and they're having inspector satellites investigating ours, and that's what they told us.
Mm-hmm. John Raymond.
That's right.
Who is
the U.S. Space
Force's
Command Commander.
Chief of Space Operations
Space
General
Command
John
Commander.
Raymond.
Right.
Okay. U.S. Space Command Commander.
That's it. That's what I've been saying.
But not three times fast.
Well, you just did that for me, Mrs. Future. So thank you for repeating what I hadn't said three times yet.
Now, third time's a charm.
Yeah, maybe four. In any event, as I said, it's the first substantive statement from the Space Force. So they're trying to justify their $18 billion budget.
It's almost as big as NASA's, right? Yeah, it's $4 billion less than NASA. Yeah. Pretty close, though.
So, the Russian satellite in question released that satellite in December.
The first new military service since 1947.
And they asked the Russians about it, and they said, it's to assess technical condition of domestic satellites.
U.S. domestic satellites.
Technical condition.
Mm-hmm. Right, like, can we take that satellite? Can we take them?
Yeah, I guess the fear is that this will turn space into a war-fighting domain.
Hey, intention is everything. You know, just because everybody's sending satellites up to space and checking each other out, you could start a satellite dating service just as easily as a war. Come on. It's all in your point of view.
Yeah, it's just a continuation of spy versus spy.
Yeah.
From what I can see.
That's right. Some of those spies love each other, but they have to keep it a secret.
Yeah. I guess where they start to draw the line is where instead of just surveilling, they have the capacity for taking out your satellites.
Right, right. As soon as they start acting aggressive, then we insist on consent.
Yeah, first thing you see, well, what kind of eyes do they use? And then how can I mess with those eyes?
Okay, so do we have any clues that their intentions are other than honorable?
No.
So they are just up there enjoying the view like us.
Studying technical condition. We just study technical condition. That's what we do.
Okay, let me see. Here's a little statement. Raymond noted that when the Russian satellites exhibited characteristics of a weapon, when one of those satellites released a high-speed projectile into space after being deployed in 2017, the U.S. raised the issue during the U.N. conference on disarmament the following year. Then the Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, Yelim Diaz Poblit, verification and compliance, told the conference how a 2017 Russian satellite's behavior on orbit was inconsistent with anything seen before from on-orbit inspection. So they're worried that it's a weapon, but Russia denies it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. I'm glad you're caught up.
Catching up. Fast as I can.
Trying to give you some chance to do
There's Space Force and there's Space Out Force. Guess which one I'm in.
Out Force. Space Out Force. Need one of those too, I guess. So I guess we have one of those.
Well, if you could, if you would just slow down, I could just catch up, okay? Hey, guess what time it is?
Break. Okay.
All right, here's some music. We'll be right back. And I'm going to read the rest of this article.
Keep reading, Mrs. Future. You're good at reading on the air. It's great. All right, welcome back to the show. Some more space news for you. The Solar Orbiter launches a historic mission to the sun. And this time we're going to study the solar poles, the North and the South Pole.
What's north when it comes to the sun? I mean, north points to the pole of Earth, but what happens when you get to outer space?
Well, what is north on the sun? Well, I would say something has to do with the ecliptic.
The ecliptic, that's a good guess.
Yeah,
what do you say?
The ecliptic, where most of the planets are around the equator.
Okay, so the north pole of the sun is kind of like the north pole of the solar system.
Right.
Like there's a line that sort of goes up and down between the planetary orbits.
Because we're all in pretty much the same level of the sun. We're orbiting around the equator. That's the ecliptic. So the north and the south pole are down below and above us.
Okay, so we're sending a solar orbiter to go above the solar system and below the solar system?
Yeah, it's a different orbit.
Okay.
It's a totally different orbit.
Sure.
And why, you might ask?
Why?
To study the magnetic fields around the sun, which is a big deal because one little burp from the sun can destroy all of our electronics equipment if we're unlucky, like the Carrington event of 1859.
It
could be really disastrous. And that is just one of the things the sun does.
Somebody should pass a law. Just tell the sun, don't do that.
Well, maybe it needs to. Maybe it has to burp sometimes. When are you going to stop buying burping? Because it's impolite? I don't know, Mrs. Fisher.
It's very impolite to be a star who destroys your planet's electrical system.
I know, right? Or spy satellites, at the very least. How rude. So it was a 3,790-pound spacecraft lifted off of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket, raised off the pad, Cape Canaveral Air Force, Sunday, this last Sunday, at 11:03 at night.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go for the poles. It's a collaboration with the European Space Agency and NASA.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be our first views of the sun's polar regions.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow, what do the poles look like? Maybe they have a secret Antarctica there. We don't know about it. Maybe that's where the alien base is.
It's a big mystery.
It was planned between 08 and 2013. I think originally they were going to launch it. They've been working on this idea for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. They had to figure out thermal protection because they're getting relatively close to the sun. Not as close as the Parker probe.
Really?
I think it's about 23 million miles.
Oh, so it'll be a whole million miles closer by the time they're all done.
20 million miles further away. But it's still pretty close. I mean, 23 million miles is really close to the sun.
Yeah, it would take me a long time to bike ride that.
It'll allow a lot more equipment to operate there than the Parker probe at 3 million.
Hmm.
Like cameras melt pretty badly.
Right.
At 3 million miles. But 23, they can handle. I guess you would say it's about like the heat of a pizza oven.
What?
Yeah.
I would have thought it was way hotter than that close to the sun.
No, 23 million, it's not as bad. 970 degrees Fahrenheit would be what the heat shield can handle.
Okay.
970 degrees, 520 right. Celsius,
okay.
In case you were wondering.
Yeah, and you're saying that's the heat of a pizza oven, huh? I didn't know they were that hot.
Well, they can get that hot. I mean, that's the hottest for this. That's on its way, and we'll be able to get some new information. It kind of ties in with the Parker probe and also the NUA solar telescope on Maui at the top of Haleakala.
Mm-hmm.
That's getting some of these great pictures of the sun in action.
Hmm.
The first god, really, of our species.
Yep, totally.
What is that? It's kind of funny because it also gives us a direct view of fusion in action. We're watching fusion in action every time you glance at the sun.
Right.
It's a real fusion reaction.
Very safe place for that furnace.
93 million miles away. That's pretty good. Okay, some of the other stories. The powerful radio signal from deep space that repeats itself. That's
right.
Interesting.
The fast story. Radio bursts.
Yes.
Which no one ever even noticed before 2007. Now they're the hottest thing in the universe.
Yeah. This latest, astronomers with the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME, have been studying this fast radio burst that repeats every 16.35 days.
Hmm.
1809-16 is the name of it, FRB. Every 4 days, it spits out a burst or two every hour, and then it falls silent for 12 days, and then it repeats the thing again. 4 days, two bursts every hour, silent for 12 days.
Mm-hmm.
WTF. These fast radio bursts are huge.
Mm-hmm.
They're energetic radiation releases that, now get this, they discharge as much power as 100 million suns. 100 million suns.
Every single time that they burst.
Yes.
It's so bright on the radio spectrum.
I mean, what generates that kind of power? 100 million suns.
Yeah.
Every hour.
Yeah. And not only is it that powerful, but then our detection, our tools for detecting them are so sensitive
that
they say that the things that we're detecting are less powerful than if somebody was using a cell phone on the moon.
Yeah, because they're that far away. This FRB 1809-16 is another galaxy.
They think. They're still putting their theories together about how to identify which galaxy it's a part of.
Yeah, somewhere out there. Really,
they don't even know why
there.
The periodicity is happening. They don't know why it's so infrequent. They don't know why it's repeating.
Right. The outskirts of a spiral galaxy 500 million light years from Earth.
Mm-hmm.
500 million light
years.
That's
their best guess. Yeah. All right. So fast radio bursts.
Yeah.
That's
what
where
are
a
they?
Lot of new research is happening.
Yeah. Is it because of an orbital period, which it turns around every so often and it hits us as it orbits?
You're asking
rotates?
Me?
Pulsar orbits. They're trying to figure it out.
Ask the scientists.
Yeah. I got some other news, though, for you.
Okay.
The huge red star that might explode soon and might be able to see it.
Ooh, yeah, poor Betelgeuse.
Yeah, Betelgeuse. Okay. The star Betelgeuse has been very volatile lately, and astronomers are watching it to see if it's terminal or maybe just going through a phase.
Right. they can't tell.
Supergiant star, Betelgeuse, we can see getting dimmer at an unprecedented pace over the past few months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some astronomers think, this might be a process of collapse that precedes a supernova explosion.
Right.
So it gets dim and goes boom, and will light up the night sky.
for about a second.
No, 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 no. It stays light for a while. If it was a second, it would be a little disturbing. It goes supernova. It could be visible in the daytime and appear brighter than the full moon for a few weeks.
Whoa!
A few weeks.
Ooh, that could spook some people.
Yes.
Hmm.
The last time humans were treated to such a sight was the 17th century.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow, I can't wait. All right, Betelgeuse.
Yeah, Betelgeuse. So if the sky is inexplicably bright at night for weeks, it's probably Betelgeuse exploding. And keep in mind, that happened a long time ago, because the light is just reaching us.
Not Betelgeuse, some other neutron star.
No, Betelgeuse.
Betelgeuse.
If it blew up.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying that if we see it, it's because it happened a long time ago.
Right.
It already happened. We're not going to change anything.
Well, it exploded a long time ago. Now the light is still having its way with us.
Right. Yeah. Apparently, people have been watching Betelgeuse for quite a while, and they believe that it's the kind of star that no matter what happens, it's on the brink of collapse because it's only got about another 100,000 years of its life. And at some point between now and 100,000 years from now, for sure, it's going to collapse.
Yeah, 100,000. Well, we're hoping it'll be next week or something.
Yeah, it'd be nice if it was during our lifetime.
Yeah, it'd be nice if it'd be next week.
Yeah.
Then we can really appreciate it.
Well, nice for us, not so great for Betelgeuse.
Well, it's already happened for them.
Yeah. Maybe Betelgeuse wants to be a neutron star.
Yeah, it's going through its birthing
normal
phase to
cycle.
Its next cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's birthing its next phase.
Yeah, yeah. Spit out all those electrons and protons and just keep your neutrons to yourself.
And hey, if it's all alive, who knows what it's creating? Something profoundly interesting, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I'd mention that. I thought that was fun.
All right, so Betelgeuse watch.
NASA names Axiom Space to build its space hotel.
Oh, that's a great article. Tell us about Axiom.
You know how in 2001 they had the space hotel? It's always been an icon we've grown up with. Mm-hmm. It was the Hilton, I think, in 2001.
Hmm.
Well, it looks like the first one will be Axiom. Axiom will be building. NASA will be ferrying private astronauts to visit the International Space Station soon. And where will these people stay?
Well, that's some big news, too.
Yeah.
NASA is basically putting an Airbnb at the International Space Station. They're going to charge $35,000 a night for people to go stay there.
Yeah, so, you know, this will be like institutions and corporations that provide resources to the space program in one way or another.
Sounds cheaper than a ride on
like
the Virgin Galactic.
Boeing or SpaceX execs, you know. They'll be value-added people that are up there. So they're not going to stay in a room just full of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have something more like the room in Barbarella at the beginning of the spaceship, where it's more of a living room scene, you know.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, you know, you want a living room. You don't want to be partying in the control room. You have to.
So this is a new company, Axiom. So Bigelow is aced out. They don't have a shot at it. Or I guess they already got to build their room on the space station.
Yeah, Axiom's trying to build a commercial module, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much more scientific that way, isn't it? Module?
A module, yeah. Yeah, because they're just going to go stick a bubble on a port at the International Space Station and inflate a new room there, right?
Inflate.
That's what Bigelow did.
That's inflation for you.
All right. Well, congratulations, Axiom, for winning that NASA contract. We'll be back after this break with more Dr. Future Show.
So here's a nice little reflection for you. There's a really nice piece in Gizmodo that says, "Do you think in words?"
Do you think in words?
Do you think in words?
Well, I
are you
do
aware
think
of your
in
own
words.
Consciousness? You do you?
I do think in words.
Like before you say what you're saying, do you think out the entire sentence?
Well, I'm a wordsmith, and I do sometimes hear the lyric in my head before it comes out my mouth, but it really depends on what frame of consciousness I'm in. I tend to be more poetic sometimes and more analytical other times, and they seem to come from different parts of my brain.
Okay. All right. Because in this piece, they talk about how there was a blog post recently entitled Today, I learned that not everyone has an internal monologue, and it has ruined my day. That basically, that some people hear an internal narrative, while others don't. Mm-hmm. They don't hear an internal voice at all.
What do you think they hear instead? Or how do you think their consciousness
works? I'd say most of my thoughts don't quite reach the level of words, that there's a level of processing in the brain that is non-verbal, but is easily translated into verbs.
Well, there's two hemispheres in the brain, yeah. Right? There's the intuitive, more non-verbal side of your brain that tends to think in pictures, and then there's the more analytical, verbal side of your brain that tends to think more
in words. But I think there's a pre-sensory modality, a pre-sensory mode or an area that's processing information before it takes form, before the word, you might say. Yeah, that it comes from somewhere. Words don't just suddenly appear.
Okay. Right?
They come from a place in our awareness where we're forming them. Mm-hmm. And that process of forming is what they're referring to in this article. And that this might give us an idea about how to study our consciousness better.
All right. So here, the author is describing herself. I, for example, am a person who hears my own thoughts in an almost conversational way, as with dialogue. I'm best able to describe my thoughts as a kind of chat with a friend, but the friend is your own consciousness. Okay, so that's one way of thinking. That's thinking in words, right?
Yeah.
So what other options are there? The non-language thought organization types that you're talking about.
I think there's a layer where there's just no, it's pre-words. It's where words come from. It's a sea of potentia, as Nick Herbert would say.
One of the characters in the article puts it an associative web, where fruits are hanging that you can pick.
Sometimes when I'm thinking about who should meet who, mm-hmm. I don't really see, but I imagine different people. And when you think of different people in your mind, do you think of what they look like or do you think of how they feel like?
So there's a sort of a lateral web that's connecting these
different
things.
To me, it's more like how people feel like. I have a web of feelings based on how I feel towards different people. And then I can see compatibilities within that web of feelings.
Oh, and it's not a word type association.
No, it's a resonance.
There's
it's
a similar pattern or something. Like
Joe, or Irks. Oh, I think of Eric, so it's like a different feeling or vibe that you have with each person that creates a memory, a resonance memory of some sort.
And that's great. That's a way. It's a very intriguing way of thinking about thinking.
Yeah, and what is actually going on there? So anyway, I thought that Gizmodo piece was worth reading, checking out.
I agree. I think it's very inspiring to give you a new frame of what's going on inside your own universe.
Yeah. So do you hear sentences in your head?
Absolutely. Yes, I do chat with my higher consciousness. That's pretty much how we communicate.
But do you hear more than one voice?
Undoubtedly.
Yes, I think the brain also is some kind of intergalactic transceiver that's just picking up information from all over the universe and other dimensions and stuff, and they can take the form of being some characters. I think your subpersonalities can vocalize in your mind. They have more access to your internal sea of potentia.
Sure. Well, the less attached you are to any one particular mode of what I call your accumulated personality, then the more you're in touch with the universal consciousness and the more you have access to everything. There's a story I heard recently about Amma, the great teacher, who apparently received a physics degree.
Yeah.
And some of the physicists from the university were scoffing that this was given an honorary degree to someone who'd had a third grade education. And some of these scoffing physicists went and asked her a question about physics that was, really difficult to answer and that only the highest physicists could even address. And she just took a moment and gave this physicist the answer, and it blew the doors off.
Yeah, she had some real information.
Real information, but he said, "How did you do that?" And she said, "Well, it's because I'm nobody, because I'm not trying to be anybody, so I have access to everything."
Well,
I thought that was a cool, mysterious way to respond.
Yeah, well, it's that cosmic search engine we're always talking about.
Right.
There are lots of ways to access it. Uh-huh. And here's another very strange one I like to get in terms of accessing a search engine, maybe not quite cosmic, but this is using technology. Our friend Gabrielle sent the story to us on how a South Korean TV show reunites a mother with her dead daughter via virtual reality.
Oh, yes. A real Black Mirror episode, that one.
Yeah, only this is real life.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the mom wears a VR headset and touch-sensitive gloves, and she walks around in a green screen set interacting with a 3D model of her daughter.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting, the idea that virtual reality gives you another pathway to experience your consciousness and to tap your emotions. And it's actually quite valid that it does that, like any kind of good art.
It seemed to really trigger off her emotions in this. Like she was seeing her daughter before her, her daughter she missed dearly. And even a representation of her daughter was valuable. I guess like a picture is valuable.
Mm.
Only we're taking pictures from beyond just a picture to something more multisensory.
Yeah. Well, and I don't really think it's a substitute as much as when you intentionally engage in an experience, you give yourself permission for healing. And so if you're doing that in a context like a virtual reality simulation, the fact that you're there already is opening the door.
Yeah. Though I tell you, this whole story got attention because it wasn't just that the interaction of helping a mom getting over her grief. I think most people would agree with that. Whatever it takes to go through your grief process more completely, that's good. But that the whole thing was broadcasted on national television.
Mm-hmm.
For the general public, are they ready to see that kind of personal?
Right. Some people are offended that personal intimacy
grieving
is exploited for public ratings. But come on, what is the news? It's all the exploitation of intimate
experiences, people
emotional experiences to publicize it, to get on the public airwaves and heighten the senses. You can be cynical about it, but it shows that we all have those universal emotions.
Yeah. And as our pictures get smarter, they're not just flat things on a piece of paper anymore, that they're interactive 3D avatars with synthetic sentience, simulating people we knew and loved from the past. Could get quite interesting.
Yeah. Well,
the Black Mirror episode, for example.
Really a comparison between the affection one has for one's favorite doll and the affection one has for one's favorite dog.
Unless the synthetic versions of your best friends that have died or relatives have a life of their own and they start developing and bonding in new and profound ways with you, then it's no longer just a representation of someone, but
I guess then you could compare it to how people feel about maybe a car that they've built themselves.
For starters, but you're still underestimating the power of the AI and robotics and synthetic.
I'm not underestimating it. I'm trying to create an analogy.
You're right. It initially, like a car or whatever, you can love that. But when you start thinking of it as another person, that's where you got to watch it because that's the edge, right? That's where it's the bleeding edge for this.
I'm so glad that earlier in the show, we were talking about this idea of anthropomorphizing things because a person's capacity to feel love comes from there.
All right. Welcome back to the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show. Yes, we're going to talk a little bit about the coronavirus in this half hour, our final half hour, an update. Bobby Wilder will be checking in a moment. I've been fielding a lot of interesting articles and stories about YouTube movies. It's been a very popular topic out there. I'd like to give you folks a little rundown on what I've discovered so far that I think I can pass on to you in a few moments. Some basic stats. For every 1,000 people that get sick from the virus, from the coronavirus, 100 will be seriously sick. 100 out of 1,000.
Based on the current headcount.
Current headcount of what they're figuring.
Mm-hmm.
And then of those 100, 2 to 3 might die. 2.5%.
2.5%. So what did people say about that statistic?
That seems to be the generally believable thing right now. Up until now, we believe that you have this incubation period of 14 days. Now there's some evidence to suggest that it's longer, that it might be 24 days for the incubation. And during that time, you can pass on the virus, even though you might not have any symptoms.
Should we be afraid?
Well, if they let people out after 14 days, then those people are still infectious. They could still cause the spread. And if there's a super spreader among them, it could be worse.
I see. So you think everybody who even has a whiff of a symptom that might be the coronavirus should just stay home for the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks?
Well, I think you should get tested. I think that's the next thing we're researching right now is the testing. And Bobby will probably give us some information on that.
Hey, welcome to the show, Bobby.
Hey, Bobby, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And all right. Welcome back. What's new? What's got your attention on this arena?
I think the numbers are up. I think WHO is allowed into China as of yesterday. So they'll have
World Health Organization.
Better reporting. Yeah, they'll have better reporting from now on. And the other thing is, I think Beijing is going into a lockdown mode.
Yeah,
right
I read
now.
An article about
Beijing
that.
Itself.
In fact, I have a Google Translate of a Chinese article about exactly what the people of Beijing are being told they have to do. It's called a strictly closed management of residential quarters. Closer management of the village is further tightened. Checkpoints are set at the entrances and exits. Residence and vehicle vouchers are used for entry and exit. Entering personnel must wear masks and perform temperature detection. The sub-district township is responsible for implementing the closure measures. And I could go on and on.
Yeah, don't read this.
Dr. Future's getting bored.
Don't read on the air.
It's okay. Please.
Don't read.
No, it's good. Because I'm very bad at reading this information.
No, it's not good. It goes in one ear and out the other for many, many people. It's better to have conversational.
Strict registration of people arriving in Beijing. On the day of their arrival in Beijing, personnel should report their health status to the community in which they live and cooperate in completing the registration of personal information. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah, thanks, Mrs. See, I think she was a librarian in a past life. She's got to read to me.
What past life?
Actually.
This life. I have to keep track of thousands of bits of information.
All right.
I have dyslexia, so I cannot read.
That's good. Anything. That's good for radio, Bobby.
I can't do it. Thank you.
So are we over 1,000 deaths yet? I mean, are we hitting 1,000 deaths
yet? If you go to the CDC and the WHO website, which is out of John Hopkins, right now it's reading 1,018 deaths. And then confirmed cases is 43,146.
Yeah.
So right now, again, you have to take this with a grain of salt because they don't even have the test kits to even verify that these people are
What's the story?
Oh, so you're saying this is just guesswork?
Yes, because what's happening is most of the people are either sent home or if they're really sick, they're sent into these hospitals and quarantined and they're exposed to other people that are sick.
Yeah.
And then maybe after that, a lot of them just die of pneumonia, and they just say it's pneumonia.
Yeah, so it could be corona, but it comes across as pneumonia.
Yeah,
and they die.
They're saying most of the cases.
Right.
So there are scientists saying, well, maybe you should put in a factor of anywhere from 2, 3, 4, or 10, or people are saying maybe 16 factor to get some real numbers of what's really happening.
Well, sounds like it's all guesswork.
So what about Dr. John Campbell? You sent some links to him. He seems like an interesting fellow who's been looking at this work.
He's out of England, and he's a retired scientist. He's researching every day. I think the most interesting is he looked at that Lancet report, which is like the New England Journal of Medicine of England.
Yes.
And they were tracking a Nepali worker that was in Hunan and then got sick on January 1st. And then, showed some symptoms, and then he was allowed to go back to Nepal, then he was in the hospital, and then he was confirmed to have the virus, then he got better, and then actually, it wasn't until 28 days later that they took another test to see that there was no longer a virus, but he could have been transmitting up to 28 days, like a month, 24 days.
Really? So you'd say you're in consensus?
Source of the 24.
Are there any evidence as well that suggests 24 days as the incubation period?
I heard another source of Singapore, somebody from Singapore showing symptoms and wasn't cleared until after 24 days. So I think the Lancet report is a clear one that
suggests 24
shows
days,
some concern. Okay. Well, 28 days.
28. That's even worse. Oh, God.
Yeah.
We have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. We have Wendell in Reno who says he has a coronavirus info update.
Well, bring him on. Let's talk to Bobby.
Hi, Wendell.
Hi. Yeah, the last 24 hours, the World Health Organization has made two announcements. They have an official name now for the coronavirus. It's coronavirus pandemic, so it's CVCD-19. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be the official designated term for the coronavirus for the future. And the other good news that I could share with your listeners,
yes,
is they said beginning in April, the coronavirus will start to disappear because it only thrives in cold temperatures.
Yeah.
Colder climates.
Right.
It likes colder climates, but so as it gets warmer, it will die out. Okay.
Yeah, so they said starting in April, it's going to start to fade out. And the other thing is they have the official name now for it.
Great. Yeah, that's good news.
Thank you, Wendell.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for checking in.
You bet.
Yeah. You hear that, Bobby?
Yeah, they're calling it COVID-19. COVID-19 as the official name of this virus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which is like coronavirus December 2019, COVID-19.
Yeah. What's interesting is this virus does stay on smooth surfaces for several days, not just hours. That's why you see these machines, you know, it's like what they were doing with Lysol, but they have these huge machines that are blowing this, it looks like a fog or a gas.
Yeah, it looks like they're spraying insecticide down the streets of Wuhan. Oh, man. Yeah, it's a way of killing the virus, I guess, huh?
Well, we're not sure what's in those sprays, but I would suspect something like Lysol. Apparently what works is 71% ethanol, rubbing alcohol, or higher, and then bleach, but 0.1%, so a very small amount. You know, you can dilute the bleach a tremendous amount and just wipe down things. Seems to work very well.
Yeah.
Or hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah.
You only need, like, instead of 3% hydrogen peroxide, which you get in the brown bottles, you can do that to, I think, 0.1%, which is a very small amount.
Yeah,
it works fine.
Too.
Just wipe down or gargle with it or whatever you want to do.
Before you go to bed, gargle.
Yeah.
Okay, so it may have a longer incubation period than we thought, but it's also more susceptible to simple remedies than we thought.
After kissing someone, gargle.
Yeah.
Since it is Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Someone sneezes in your face, gargle.
But don't ever forgive them. That's so rude.
Especially if something weird happens 28 days later.
Yeah.
Good. Wow.
All right. So we're still keeping light, huh?
Okay,
you guys don't seem like you believe that it's a giant
I'm serious.
This is like, this is like humanity.
This is like gallows humor, Mrs. Future.
Oh, it's you could have fooled me.
Wow. No, this could be serious, wouldn't you say, Bobby?
Well, even, you know, the WHO general director warns that we may be only seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
So they just landed there yesterday. So who knows what they're going to come up with.
Yeah, I think one of the things this really shows is that you just don't know what information to trust coming out of China, right? We don't know if the numbers are real. We don't know if they're covering it up. We don't know if it's a hoax. We don't know if it's much worse than they say.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like all over the map.
What about the rumors? I've heard that this is a weaponized virus that's gotten out of the lab.
I mentioned that there is a maximum security laboratory level 4. Which is usually...
Okay, hold on. Hold that thought for a second. Yeah. We're going to look at this. The maximum security lab 4 that the coronavirus came from.
All right. The Wuhan maximum security lab.
One of the stories investigating.
Okay.
Okay, we got a question from the audience as well, but I wanted to complete the story about how the Wuhan virus supposedly came from a highly secure bio research lab. What can you tell us about that, Bobby?
What was interesting was if you just Google maximum security level 4 laboratory in China. The main one that comes up is in Wuhan, and it's very, very close. It's like 12 miles outside the city center. And there was an interesting interview a couple days ago by this law professor, Dr. Francis Boyle, and he actually wrote the Treaty for International Biological Weapons, and it was signed by both, it was unanimously voted by both houses of the Congress and Senate, and it was approved by George Bush Sr., and it was putting down rules and regulations on how biological weapons could be used or not used in the world. He was the guy that wrote this law, you know. And then he just said a couple days ago, you know, I think you should take a look at Wuhan and look at this facility, because this facility is funded mostly by WHO, which is funded by the United States, which is funded by Bill Gates. It turns out that this research facility 2 years ago was looking at the bat coronavirus and was given tools, CRISPR-Cas9 tools, to actually edit and make changes to this virus. So he suspects China is known for accidental releases of these things. I don't believe it's intentional, but
based on past patterns of behavior, it's a possibility.
So most likely, this thing was an accidental release. He's also pointing to the fact that this virus, which originated in the bat, had to have transferred to humans somehow, and then from humans, it had to be able to be vectorized and mutated to transmit from human to human.
And both those steps are something we could help nature with.
So he's suspecting that maybe the CRISPR-Cas9 tools might have vectorized and weaponized this virus.
Well, within our capacities, would you agree?
It's a possibility, right? I think it's
And in the future, it'll get easier and easier, too, right? It's an evolving art form, or science, I should say, to manipulate DNA. That's another question. We got a question from Gregory, who was wondering about the DNA information. He says, does anyone know how to explain this will be helpful in making a vaccine now that we've got the complete DNA sequence of the virus? Is that possible pretty fast?
What's interesting is there were researchers in the United States that already had the complete DNA. In fact, if you go to the Dr. Future site and you just go down and you can actually download the DNA sequence yourself, it's a PDF, and you can see the whole genetic sequence of this virus.
So we've known it for a bit now, for at least a month, right?
At least a month, maybe longer. We don't know. But the problem is these vaccines, they're not effective on the first round that it goes around the world. Maybe the second time, like next year when it reoccurs, it might be helpful to have the vaccine then. It's just not possible to deal with this spread right now.
No, I see. But that information could also be used to weaponize the virus too, right? The DNA, once you have the sequence?
It looks like it's already weaponized. I mean, if you look at it, you know, it's spreading as fast as it can.
Right. So spread is, and that's part of that is that you want something to spread really quickly in multiple ways and have a long incubation period with no signs of being ill. And that.
So it looks like the perfect storm, I think, that's coming up.
So is the scenario here that people realize this virus is worse than even we thought before, and therefore they tell people to stay home, and since people stay home, then we just have chaos in China? Like the factories stop running food stops being delivered?
I've heard that they're trying to keep the factories running, though, in China. They don't want to stop the factories, and so they've kind of got a split mind about that.
It's true, the Foxconn factory in Shenzhen, which is on the border with Hong Kong.
Yeah, does Apple stuff.
Open, that produces only 10% of the Apple iPhones. The other large factories are Beijing and Shanghai, and there's no report that they're going to go 100% up there. So I don't know how the supply of iPhones is going to be rolling out very quickly here.
Well, it seems to me that the Earth should be able to have all of the humans take a month off and not go crazy. I mean, you know, something short of that should be manageable.
Yeah. I think it's good to get buy some good cookbooks and
some,
you know,
nuts, some dried food, and keep it in your larder.
Yeah, and learn how to cook at home. And in Beijing, this lockdown is going down. They're saying that restaurants and places of gathering have to close.
That's right. They said they don't want people gathering. They want people to stay home.
Oh, that reminds me.
Except for, wait, the exception before we change the subject?
No, it's related.
Do you want to...
Those poor folks that were stranded on the boats, the passenger liners.
In Japan. They're still stranded.
They're stranded, and they were able to order some wine from a Japanese company that delivers via drone, deliver wine to the boat. Apparently, they got several cases by drone and been having regular parties while they're in quarantine for the virus. So I thought that was a little light story in the midst of this.
Meanwhile, thing. Thanks, one of Gabby, the things that I saw off of Twitter was a film of one of these neighborhood lockdown centers. Apparently, people are not supposed to go out, except if they must go out, then they're, like, the grocery store is closed, but the local government is in charge of making sure that people have food, but they're not in charge of delivering it, so people can come and get these rations that are being laid out for them. Anyway, it's just a crazy thing that seems to be going on there. People are being told they can't leave their homes, but if they do leave their homes because they're out of food, they go to these government facilities where they're being rationed.
Now, how long have people been in quarantine now at this point? They're in the second group of people now where the 14-day quarantine has been going on for a while. There should be people being let out now, it seems to me.
Quarantine. In Hunan
in our country. We've been bringing back plane loads full of people from Wuhan at least 2 weeks ago, maybe even longer. Are they being let out now? Or are they going to keep them longer now that we think the incubation period might be as long as 28 days? You know, and that's what I'm wondering.
Well, this information about the 28 days just came out yesterday.
Yeah, so they're probably, so if they're let out after 14, they still could be spreading the disease.
That's right. Or they could be super spreaders. You know, you never know. Yeah.
Right. Now, how many of those people that we brought back were tested for the virus? Probably all of them, right? How many of them had it?
The ones that are detained right now have the virus. You know, that's why.
And that's a handful of them. Because we brought back hundreds of people on these airplanes. And we've got, a dozen cases in the U.S.?
Yes, I think at least 11. And then there was a new case in San Diego. I forget.
One more case.
And there is one United States citizen that has died in Hunan.
Right. But not in the U.S. yet.
But not in the U.S. So we do have one American citizen.
So on our final minute for this week, anything in particular? Do you order masks this week? Or do you think?
Well, you know, my suggestion is not to worry, but, you know, if you want to be super prepared, just go down to the Home Depot, something like that, Lowe's, and just get a respirator. Like you're going to sand your...
Sanding respirator, okay.
Yeah, but you want to get a just order online a P100 filter.
P100, not N95?
Yeah. No, P100 is better. It can absorb liquids.
Okay, that's for the coronavirus. All right, well, thank you, Bobby, for bringing us an update. Bobby Wilder.
Another
fine week of stories to share with you, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Bobby, for being on the show.